From KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Most of us middle and working class Americans are always looking for a good bargain. In an attempt to make ends meet, we might shop at Walmart or Amazon or eat at McDonald's and Taco Bell, even if we may not like the business practices of those companies. But the idea of cheap goods and services is so deeply intertwined with our current global economic system that it has become almost impossible to extricate ourselves from it. How did the pursuit of cheap things, which includes labor and care, become part of the fabric of our lives? Telling the history of the world using the idea of cheapness as a lens in a new book is my guest, the award-winning author and activist Raj Patel. He's currently a research professor at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas, Austin, and a senior research associate at the Unit for the Humanities at Rhodes University. He's written several books, including Stuffed and Starved, The Hidden Battle for the World Food System, and The Value of Nothing, How to Reshape Market Society and Redefine Democracy. He joins me to discuss his newest book, co-authored with Jason W. Moore. It's called A History of the World and Seven Cheap Things, A Guide to Capitalism, Nature, and the Future of the Planet. Welcome to the program, Raj.
It's good to be back with you, Sonali.
Thanks so much for joining us. Yes, we've had you on about your earlier two books. This book is even more ambitious and all-encompassing than even the first two. You used to write about food politics. Now you write about capitalism as a whole, although food politics is still very much a part of your work. So let's start with the food aspect of it. You open your book with talking about chickens, chicken farming, chickens, you know, being one of the most popular, if not the most popular meat in the world. Why does mass chicken farming become a useful starting point for understanding how cheap things and the pursuit of cheap things have dominated us?
Well, Sonali, the reason we went for chicken is because a lot of people are talking at the moment about this idea of the Anthropocene, an era that's marked by things like, in the geographical record, we're leaving very sort of signature traces like the radiation from nuclear tests or plastic. By 2050, there'll be more plastic in the sea than fish. And these are considered to be the signs of, human habitation of the planet and the destruction that we're wreaking. And what we want to do is shift the discussion away from thinking about anthropos, of just humans being responsible for this, and shifting the discussion really to understand that it's not humans being humans that causes the catastrophic changes and state shifts in planetary ecology. It's not humans doing that, it's capitalism. And nothing exemplifies this more than chicken. Right now, there are 12 billion chickens alive, but not for long. Every year, humans go through about 50 billion chickens. So you can imagine that one of the other signature traces of our times will be chicken bones, trillions of chicken bones. Now, the way that we tell the story of chicken is not that, chicken has magically become the world's most popular bird. The only reason that this bird, Gallus gallus domesticus, is as popular as it is because of these seven cheap things, seven strategies that capitalism has adopted, and strategies that are sort of running out. The cheap things don't last forever. And what we're suggesting in this book is that actually the chicken McNugget is augury for a fairly substantial state shift in the way that the planet works, and a sign of a very big crisis in capitalism.
Well, you point out a very crucial concept in your book, which I think is a good place to go next, which is that this idea that human beings were separate from nature was important to as an underlying assumption for this pursuit of cheap things, that we were above nature or superior to nature. But this was not a natural idea to adopt. Where did this idea come from, and how does it sort of underpin a lot of the economic system today?
Well, I mean, it's an idea that emerges sort of most fully at the end of feudalism in Europe. And by the time Columbus discovers, in shiver quotes, the New World, it's an idea that's already flourishing. The idea that on the one hand you have nature, and it's very interesting that on the other hand, the opposite of nature under capitalism is society, right? That no other human civilization has quite ordered the world in the way that capitalist societies have, where on the one hand you have people, and people classed in very particular ways, right? The class of society isn't it doesn't often include women to start off with. It certainly doesn't include indigenous people or people of color. Under the European optic, certainly people of color and often women are outside of society in important ways. And that dividing line of nature on the one hand, which can be exploited and used, and on the other hand, society where the economy functions, that binarism is alive and well by, at the beginning of what we call the long 15th century. So it begins round about then, at the sort of the that's the birthplace of capitalism. This isn't to say that other societies haven't exploited nature. They have. But no society has really organized itself on the premise that there is this sort of binarism between human society on the one hand and nature on the other. That's a sort of signature move of early modern capitalism that we live with today.
So let's talk about this concept of cheapness as well. Cheap things are, we're all today attracted to the idea of cheapness because we can afford them. Many of us are struggling in the global economy. And so if we can cheaply provide for our family, we accept it. But then there's the other side of that word cheap, right? That when something is cheapened, its value is less than it should be. So how do you explain, or why did you choose to use this phrase, this term, to view the world economy, and use that as a lens to use to view the world economy?
Well, the reason to go for this idea of cheap is really to point to both the active requirement for capitalism to suppress the cost and the value of certain kinds of things in order for capitalism to flourish, but also to point to the finitude, to point to the fact that this stuff is running out. You can't suppress the value of nature and of care work and of human lives and of labor without people organizing and striking back, and without a long-term cost in terms of the natural world, a long-term consequence in terms of the way that the web of life is able to sustain or not sustain us. And so that's what the word cheap is doing here. It's pointing out that there are that while this may appear like a bargain, it certainly isn't. But it's also pointing to the fact that when capitalism was born, there were crises in a range of things, where there was a climate crisis in early modern Europe, there was the Black Death as well, and these systemic crises pushed, essentially augured the end of feudalism and birthed something new, and that new thing was capitalism. And what we're doing is both drawing on history to be able to point to how these crises, made capitalism today, but also how it is that because of capitalism's strategy of cheapening things, we're heading to another crisis. And that's something to be concerned about, because it's not, there's nothing inevitable about what follows capitalism is going to be great and glorious. I mean, it could just be the sorts of things that we see in India, where all of a sudden we move towards incredible authoritarianism and contemporary fascism.
And here in the US, of course, to an extent. So the seven cheap things that you look at in your book: nature, money, work, care, food, energy, and lives. Let's look at money. Just like the idea of separating humans from nature was a requirement for capitalism, the idea of getting people to use money as currency was not something that was considered very normal or acceptable, right? So, how did money and the use of money historically lay the groundwork for where we are today?
Well, I mean, it's again, civilizations have been using things to exchange with for a while. You know, you've got your economies that use cowrie shells, and you know, I mean, in prisons you can use cigarettes. But what's important, I think, about the argument we're making is it's not just money; it's cheap money. It's money that is made available through banks and governments, guaranteeing that for capitalists that money is available cheaply. Let's go back to the chicken nugget. The only reason that we can have cheap chicken is because in the United States, every KFC is considered, if it's a franchise, a small business. And you can get loans up to $2 million from the federal government, underwritten and available at concessional rates. And then, of course, the industry itself gets cheap inputs for their chicken to the tune of $1.25 billion a year. So the cheapness of the money is important. It's not merely that there are long chains of exploitation that stretch from, say, Peru and the silver mines in the 15th century, all the way to Europe. It's not just that. But it's that the availability of money for very low rates of interest is something that capitalists need. Right now, of course, interest rates are almost as low as they can possibly go. And with an economic stall on the way, there's no gas left in the tank for economists or the Federal Reserve to cut interest rates at the rate that is required to stimulate the economy again. So that's why the cheapness of money, the low interest rate, is important for capitalists, but also why it is that we're on a precipice, because when interest rates are zero, what else do you do?
Right. I mean, so it went from money being a concrete thing, or the idea of currency being a concrete thing, to also, in a way, it becoming an abstraction. I mean, governments can print more money to deal with things like inflation. They can essentially create money out of thin air, and then use taxpayer money and decide to use it in a way that doesn't necessarily benefit us. All of these things cheapens money and also fosters capitalism. Let's talk about labor. Labor is so important. Today, many of us can have iPhones because of cheap Chinese labor. The U.S. economy was built on slave labor and became the basis for the U.S. becoming a world superpower today. And I think this is one of those concepts that's easier to grasp, that capitalism requires cheap labor, right?
Mm-hmm. But it's also important to recognize how old that is, right? That there is this sort of layer cake of exploitation. Let's take one of the characters who comes up in the book quite a lot, Christopher Columbus. When he comes over to the New World, he's exploiting his workers. The sailors are treated very badly. Columbus promises them a vast reward for the first sailor who sees land. And of course, there's some guy who sees land, and Columbus says, no, I woke up in the middle of the night and saw it first, and sort of steals wages from his worker. But what you have also in Columbus's time is not just paid workers being exploited, and then a class of sort of entrepreneurs who are, paying themselves quite well, but also slave labor. Columbus inaugurated the transatlantic slave trade, as one commentator noted. But he in a letter to his patrons Ferdinand and Isabella, says, "Let us, in the name of the Holy Trinity, bring back as many slaves from the New World as can be sold." And so he's very interested in slavery, and that's in part because when he grew up in Genoa in Italy, 5% of the population of Genoa were slaves. And the idea of slavery and exploited workers and less exploited workers, and then some sort of labor royalty, and then the entrepreneurs and the capitalists at the top sitting on top of one another, that's very contemporary. We couldn't have, as you say, Sonali, we couldn't have our iPhones if it weren't for blood minerals coming from the Democratic Republic of the Congo, from janitors being exploited in Silicon Valley, from coders who are exploiting themselves in Silicon Valley, and from the sort of elite, the CEOs and the bankers who are profiting from it all. That layer cake, again, finance and entrepreneurs and wage workers and slavery, happens today. The ILO, the International Labour Organization, just released a report saying that there are 40 million slaves around on Earth today, people in conditions of modern day slavery. And that, I think, is something that you know, it ought to shock us, that actually we think that we've moved out of those, you know, those times and that era. But actually, there are more slaves today than were involved in the entirety of the transatlantic slave trade. Hmm.
Then there's the idea of cheap care. This is interesting, where you examine the sort of gendered dimension of what capitalism requires, going again back to the history of the world, because that's what this is, a history of the world, using sexism and misogyny and sex itself as a way to create these divisions, artificial divisions. Explain what you mean by cheap care.
Well, so when workers' bodies get broken, what happens to them? I mean, let's just think about, in the United States, there's not much of a healthcare system for working class people, and so it falls to a community outside the work environment to care for people. At the same time as capitalism was creating a proletariat, it was. Thinkers like Silvia Federici have observed for a long time, finding ways of essentially sort of fencing off the commons and banishing women and women's work and women's bodies into the home, and creating this new institution called the household. I mean, it's a term it's an idea that we call sort of the great domestication, that's part of capitalism. Again, in order for early modern capitalism to succeed, you need the work of being able to reproduce the workforce and to be able to care and feed for workers, and for that to be provided free. For capitalists. And that means that certain bodies get tasked with that. And you see the invention, the juridical invention of the idea of a woman, and these sort of binary sexual categories being enforced and legally prescribed through processes of colonialism and through domestic law in Europe. And so the idea here is that care work becomes the sort of thing associated with bodies that are called women's bodies. And that's that transformation, that they've always been patriarchal societies, but that transformation in this particular case works to support and is, it emerges through the production of this new working class. And so that's something that I think is tremendously important to observe, both as a colonial feature, but also as a feature within within Europe itself.
You also then write in your book, there's a chapter called Cheap Food, and in your earlier books, such as Stuffed and Starved, this was such a crucial thread. And of course, today we have a ballooning population, human population, and the challenge of how to feed this population is often used by industrial food industries and massive food companies to justify cheapening our food system even more. Cheap food, which I suppose we started with when we talked about the chicken McNugget, is this idea of cheap food is really destroying people's health and the planet, right? And this is also another thing that capitalism requires.
Right, that's it. I mean, if you're going to make it on incredibly low wages, you need cheap food. I mean, and here's the irony, of course, is that among the 30 or so poorest paid jobs in the United States, the majority are in the food system.
And which is what helps keep food cheap.
Exactly, right? You nailed it, Sonal. I mean, but it's not just that. I mean, in order for food to be cheap, you also need cheap grain, for example, and commodities subsidies for the big commodity crops like wheat and soy and corn, for instance. But the trouble with that is that you're right. It's prejudicing everyone's health, and it is destroying the environment. And here's the bit where we point out that something that is abundantly clear, that because so much fossil fuel is involved in the production of this cheap food, agriculture is both perpetrator and victim of climate change. And every serious model points to substantial reductions in the availability and the yields of crops as a result of climate change. And so while in the 20th century, up to the 20th century, this cheap food was achieved through colonialism and through the banishing of peasants from the land, these sort of important and violent social technologies, at least the soil fertility and the weather was were cooperating to some extent. But because now we've mined the fertility out of the soil and we've laced the atmosphere with so many greenhouse gases, That's not, you know, our position in the web of life has been compromised as well, and we're heading towards this state shift. And that's a very worrying moment because, again, the absence of the cheap food that capitalism has been premised on signals some fairly significant changes ahead.
And then cheap energy, I'm assuming, is intertwined with the issue of cheap food very much so. And we, you know, we are at a moment right now in the U.S. where there is a glut of fossil fuel because of the expanded fracking operations that Obama began, and now Trump is expanding and continuing. He wants coal companies to not you know, move into oblivion. He wants to bring that back. And so we are floating in cheap energy, which will destroy the planet. Already, you know, plenty of evidence that climate change is in full swing. And this is the not just a requirement for capitalism, but really is something that we, I think, can blame capitalism for more clearly than anything else. If we were ever in an existential crisis because of capitalism, it would be the climate crisis, right?
Well, that's right. But again, it's you know, it doesn't happen by magic, but it does happen through the exploitation of workers, in particular women and people of color. And it doesn't and it couldn't happen without this cheap money. There was a report that cropped up in the Washington Post a couple of weeks ago saying that 45% of oil exploration, oil and gas exploration in the United States wouldn't be profitable were it not for government subsidies. So even then, you know, yes, we're awash in this stuff, but we're awash in this stuff because these corporations have been so good at getting cheap money out of our government.
So let's end with the idea of cheap lives, which is the last part of your book. You know, it seems as though we have made the lives of so many people be devalued to things like the climate crises. But you talk in your book, Under Cheap Lives, you tackle the issue of nationalism and the idea of the nation and what community really means. Is this a place where we can start to extricate ourselves from capitalism by refusing to cheapen our lives, by refusing to accept that lives should be cheap?
I think it is. I mean, you and I were discussing before we began the problems with the idea of nationhood premised on ideas of race that are shot through with white supremacism. This isn't to be skeptical about the idea of nation in toto. I mean, for example, Jason Moore and I draw in our book on ideas that come from some of the First Nations in the United States and Canada on new ways of rearticulating humans within the web of life. And those come from the coastal Salish nations, from the Haida Nation, for example. But again, you know, capitalist nation states are premised on certain kinds of ideas of supremacy. And yes, white supremacy started it all. But of course, now, you know, again, we can look to India, where, you know, it's so interesting that you know, again, you've got a prime minister who uses social media as his bully pulpit and is scared of, you know, just peddles Islamophobia and is a champion of coal and a half dozen other things that look very, very similar to what's going on in the United States. And, you know, where you have Hindu supremacy happening there. This idea of a certain kind of supremacism and therefore the devaluation of other kinds of lives under the cover of nation is something that I think we are seeing a well-articulated resistance toward. And I do think that you know, when we have movements like the movement for Black Lives, Native Lives Matter, Idle No More, and you know, again in Canada, but you know, Indigenous rights around the world. These are incredibly inspiring ways of rearticulating, rethinking what it might be to be part of a community that's not, you know, governed by a flag and a currency.
Raj, finally, because these things are so embedded, these ways of thinking about our world are so embedded in our culture, and go back to centuries in our history, it might feel like it's too much to overturn, too much to ask for us to rethink how our world should function. Or is it? I mean, are there people who really are there now growing movements that are questioning the ravages of capitalism and challenging ourselves to just entirely reimagine the global economic system? It just seems like a huge question.
Well, I mean, it certainly is a huge question if one's doing it by oneself. And I think that that's what's important to recognize here is that if, if you're interested in renegotiating humanity's relationship with nature, you don't do that by just going out and hugging a tree and deciding that you've renegotiated your relationship with this tree and everything's great. It has to be a social process, which somehow, because we've been so individualized and we think of ourselves as, I'm just one person, what can I do? That feels onerous. But the minute you get involved in movement politics and become part of a movement, it becomes possible to have these deeper conversations with other people and recognize that actually, well, while no one has the answers, we can make the road through walking, as the Zapatistas say. What one doesn't do that as an individual kind of consumer decision. But I do think that it's important that we have these conversations. And what's inspiring, I think, is that so many movements are, breaching their silos. So the movement for Black Lives isn't, I mean, is looking at things like the carceral state and climate change and gender justice and environmental justice. Similarly, Via Campesina, the international peasant movement, is looking at gender justice and climate change as well as farming. I mean, there are ways that these movements are knitting themselves together. And what, we're trying to do in this History of the World in Seven Cheap Things is actually each of these seven things are movements already. And what we're trying to do is just, contribute to the conversations that are already going on, showing where those points of overlap and solidarity lie, so that, as we get deeper into this crisis of capitalism, we're not left with, just a default of going back to fascism, but we offer something more substantial.
Well, Raj, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Good luck with the book.
Thank you so much, Sonali. Thanks for reading it.
My guest is the award-winning writer, activist, and academic Raj Patel, a research professor at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. We've been discussing his newest book, A History of the World in Seven Cheap Things, A Guide to Capitalism, Nature, and the Future of the Planet. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.